Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, listeners. I'm your host, Amara, and this is Black Girl Gone, a true crime podcast. On this episode of Black Girl Gone, I tell you the stories of 11 women who were murdered between 1990 and 1994. Nine of those women had been strangled to death inside their own homes in Charlotte, North Carolina. When the investigation into the murders began, police did not make a connection between the victims until 22 months after the murder spree began. After four women were murdered in March 1994, investigators were able to narrow down their suspect. And when they did, they uncovered a serial killer. When people hear the words serial killer, the names that most often come to mind are Jeffrey Dahmer or Ted Bundy. They are among the most infamous serial killers in history, and statistically, most serial killers who have been caught and identified have been white men, most of whom fit a particular profile. But not all serial killers are white men, and although not as common, black serial killers do exist. The problem is, they tend to be able to hide under the radar longer because their victims, more often than not, are black women whose murders are not thoroughly investigated. In this week's story, the families of the women that were murdered in Charlotte in the early 90s know all too well what happens when police fail to identify the pattern of a serial killer in time. They believe that had police dedicated more resources when the first women were found murdered, they may have been able to recognize the pattern earlier and possibly save some of these women's lives. Over the span of 22 months, 10 women were murdered. Nine of them strangled and raped inside their own homes, and it was the connection between them that ultimately helped solve these brutal murders. The story of those nine victims begins in June 1992 with the disappearance of Caroline Love. At the time, Caroline, who was 20 years old, was working at a Bojangles restaurant as a cashier, where she had been employed for 2.5 years. Caroline was born and raised in Charlotte and attended Northeast Junior High School, where she ran track. After high school, Caroline attended Garinger High School, and after graduation, she enrolled at Central Piedmont Community College, where she studied nursing. In September 1989, Caroline began working at Bojangles. Her manager at the restaurant said that she was a hard worker who didn't mind filling in and picking up extra shifts. Quote, "She had a good work ethic. Everybody liked her," he told the Charlotte Observer. In June 1992, Caroline was living with a roommate, Sadie McKnight, in Darby Terrace Apartments on Central Ave. Her apartment was conveniently located because it was only 6 blocks from her job. On June 15, 1992, Caroline worked her normal shift, and when her shift was over, she asked her manager if she could buy a roll of quarters because she needed to do her laundry. The manager said it was fine, and so Caroline gave them a $10 bill in exchange for the quarters. Shortly after midnight, Caroline left her job and began walking home. On her way to her apartment, a cousin of hers named Robert spotted her walking and offered her a ride home. Robert said that he dropped her off at her apartment and watched her while she went inside. But it was the last time anyone in Caroline's family would ever see her again. A couple of days after Caroline was last seen going into her apartment, her sister Kathy got a call from one of the managers at the Bojangles. Kathy also worked at the restaurant at the time, but the manager was calling because Caroline had not shown up to work for 2 days, and they were concerned. After 2.5 years, Caroline had become known as a reliable, responsible employee, and so It was very unlike her to miss her scheduled shifts without calling. After getting the call, Kathy went over to her sister's apartment and knocked on the door, but no one answered, and so she left a note for Caroline asking for her to get in contact with her. But the next day, Kathy got another call from Bojangles informing her that Caroline still had not shown up for work. At that point, Kathy was becoming more concerned that something had happened, and so she reached out to Sadie, Caroline's roommate, to see if she had spoken to her. But Sadie had not, and she said that she too was concerned because it wasn't like Caroline to be gone that long without contacting her. After realizing that no one had seen or spoken to Caroline in days, Kathy decided it was time to go to the police and file a missing persons report. Once a report was filed, Kathy went back to her sister's apartment, and this time she was able to get inside and look around. And she immediately noticed that some of her sister's furniture had been moved around and that the sheets on the bed were missing. It seemed suspicious to her, but there was no other evidence that anything had happened inside that apartment. Now, when police began looking into Caroline's disappearance, investigators also went to her apartment to look for evidence, and they too found the scene somewhat suspicious. The sheets on her bed had been removed, but they were not in the apartment, and the roll of quarters she had bought to do her laundry were not there. Aside from the things that appeared out of place, there was no physical evidence, however, inside that gave police any clues about what may have happened to Caroline. Detectives followed up on a few leads, but eventually they hit a wall, and the case went cold. Caroline continued to be missing, but Charlotte police had pretty much given up their search to find her. After Caroline went missing, Sadie moved in with her boyfriend, a man named Henry Wallace, a local fast food restaurant manager who she had been dating for about 2 years, and since she could not afford the rent at her apartment, she moved in with him. But 7 months after Caroline seemingly vanished, another family would have a similar experience, except they wouldn't have to wait long to find out their loved one's fate. In February 1993, 20-year-old Shauna Hawk was living with her mother in Charlotte, where she had been born and raised. She was the second child and only daughter of Sylvia Sumter and Walter Hawk II. People who knew her described her as sweet, shy, and gentle. She attended East Mecklenburg High School and worked part-time at McDonald's while in high school. After she graduated, like Caroline, she also attended Piedmont Community College, where she studied to become a paralegal. She also worked part-time at Taco Bell at the time. Now, Shauna and her mother had remained close as she blossomed into adulthood. Her parents had split up, and Shauna stayed with her mom while her brothers moved to Atlanta with their dad. On February 19th, 1993, Sylvia came home to the apartment that she shared with Shauna to begin dinner for that evening. Normally, Shauna would have been home before her, but when Sylvia arrived at the apartment, Shauna was not there. Sylvia thought it was strange that she wasn't home yet, but when she looked in the closet and found Shauna's coat and purse, she started to get a strange feeling. Shauna's car was not there, but the fact that she had left her coat and purse was very weird, especially considering the fact that it was cold outside. Sylvia said that her daughter would have not gone anywhere without her purse, and when she saw her earlier that day, she was wearing her coat. At the time, Shauna was dating a young man named Daryl, and so Sylvia called him to see if he had seen Shauna, but he said that he hadn't seen her or spoken to her all day. After calling Daryl, Sylvia called Taco Bell, where her daughter worked, to see if she had been called to fill in a shift. But when she called the restaurant, they told her that Shauna was not on the schedule that evening. Now, while trying to track down her daughter, Sylvia also learned that Shauna was supposed to pick up her godson at 3 p.m. from daycare, but she had never shown up. When Sylvia looked in Shauna's purse, she found her keys missing, along with her money. And none of it made any sense. After Daryl found out that Shauna was missing, he went over to Sylvia's to see if he could help her in finding where Shauna had gone. Once he was there, they decided that they should call the police and file a missing persons report. After police took the report, Daryl decided to take a look around the two-story apartment to see if maybe he could find any clues about where Shauna had gone. He went from room to room, eventually making his way downstairs to a bathroom where he noticed that the shower curtain was outside of the tub. When he entered the bathroom and pulled back the shower curtain, he made a horrifying discovery. Curled in the fetal position, submerged in water, was Shauna. Daryl ran upstairs and told Sylvia to call 911. When EMS arrived, they rushed Shauna to the hospital where she was officially pronounced dead. The following day, when an autopsy was performed, the medical examiner determined that Shauna had suffered blunt force trauma before her death, but the ultimate cause of her death was ligature strangulation. When detectives began investigating Shauna's murder, they immediately became suspicious of her boyfriend, Daryl. Since there had been no forced entry at Shauna's home, investigators believed that she likely knew her killer and trusted them enough to let them in her home. Detectives interviewed Daryl for weeks, but ultimately were unable to find any evidence connecting him to Shauna's murder or any motive for why he would have wanted to kill her. Other friends and family members were also interviewed, but investigators could not narrow down any other suspects. Eventually, this case also became cold, and investigators placed it on the back burner. Sylvia said that detectives would not talk to her or update her about their investigation or lack thereof. While Sylvia continued to push for answers and help in finding who killed her daughter, yet another young woman and fast food worker would also be strangled to death 4 months after Shauna's brutal murder and 1 year after Caroline vanished after her shift at Bojangles. In June 1993, 24-year-old Audrey Spain was living in an apartment in Charlotte after moving there from Bayboro, where she was originally from. The youngest of five children, people who knew Audrey described her as a strong-willed, self-assured young woman. When she was younger, she practiced karate and had perfect attendance in middle school. After high school, she attended Denmark Technical and Horry Georgetown Technical Colleges. After Audrey graduated from Horry Georgetown Technical College, she decided to move to Charlotte to start a new chapter in her life. And she landed a job as an assistant manager at a Taco Bell near the Eastland Mall. According to her family and friends, Audrey was happy with her life in Charlotte. She had a job, an apartment, and had even bought herself a new car. Everything seemed to be going really well. But in June 1993, Audrey's family would join the growing list of Charlotte families of young Black women missing or murdered that year. On June 23, 1993, Audrey was scheduled to be at work at Taco Bell at 6:30 p.m., but when her shift started, Audrey had not shown up or called out. This behavior was unusual for her, and so her manager, Mark, decided that he would go over to her apartment and check on her. When he arrived at the building, he could see Audrey's car parked outside, and so he left and decided to call her and leave a message for her on her answering machine. The next day, June 24th, after still not hearing from Audrey, Mark again drove past her apartment, and her car was still in the same spot. He was really starting to worry about Audrey, and so he called her sister to let her know what was going on, but she didn't answer his call, and so he left a message for her. That evening, Audrey was scheduled to work, but again, she did not show up for her shift. By this time, Audrey's sister still had not returned Mark's phone call, and so he took it upon himself to call the police. After getting the call, police drove past her apartment a few times and knocked on the door, but they were never able to make contact with her. 2 days after Audrey was last seen, on June 25th, the maintenance workers at her apartment entered her apartment through the glass door. Now, it's not exactly clear if they were sent there by Mark or the police or if this was just scheduled maintenance, but When the workers entered the apartment, they found Audrey lying on her bed, deceased. When detectives arrived to investigate the scene, they noticed that there were no signs of forced entry at the apartment. They could also tell that the killer had washed the body in an attempt to cover up any potential evidence. Once the autopsy was performed, it was determined that Audrey had been strangled to death, just as Shauna had 4 months before. But despite the similarities, investigators were not making a connection. Both women were in their 20s, both strangled, and both worked at Taco Bell. It would seem as if these coincidences would raise flags, but no one was looking into the fact that these crimes were possibly connected. There were different detectives on the cases and clearly no coordination between them. In Audrey's case, her family and friends were also interviewed, but no suspect emerged, and they couldn't find any evidence to point them in one direction or the other. But Caroline, Audrey, and Shauna were not the first victims, and they would not be the last. In fact, no one in Charlotte knew how many more victims there would be before the killer would be caught. Thank you to Astepro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples. If you're an allergy sufferer like me, then this time of year can be really difficult. But this year, I found an allergy medicine that really helped, and I want to share it with you. It's called Astepro. Astepro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It is the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray, and it starts working in 30 minutes while other allergy sprays take hours. Astepro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter spray, and it starts working in 30 minutes while other allergy sprays take hours. It's also the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray, and it delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing. Astepro has really worked well for me, and if you're suffering from allergies, you should give it a try. Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astepro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can Astepro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astepro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies. Life doesn't happen bi-weekly, so why should payday? The money you earn can be in your hands today with Earnin. Earnin is an app that gives you access to your pay as you work, up to $100 per day or up to $750 per pay period. Just download the Earnin app and verify your paycheck, then access up to $100 a day as you work and leave an optional tip. Any money you access plus tips are automatically repaid from your paycheck. Maybe you need the extra money for an unexpected bill or to fill your gas tank. Make Earnin a part of your financial routine and join Earnin's over 3.5 million customers who say things like, "When I think about Earnin, I think about financial stability, security. It gives me a lot of peace of mind." Download Earnin today, spelled E-A-R-N-I-N, in the Google Play or Apple App Store. When you download the Earnin app, type in Black Girl Gone under podcast when you sign up. It'll really help the show. Black Girl Gone under podcast. Earnin is a financial technology company, not a bank. Subject to your available earnings, daily max pay period pay, and location. See earnin.com/TOS for details. Bank products are issued by Evolve Bank & Trust, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
In the early 90s, a series of brutal murders took place in Charlotte, North Carolina, over a 22-month period, and 10 women were brutally murdered. But despite the similarities in these cases, it would take the Charlotte police months before they were able to put the pieces together. After Audrey Spain's murder in June 1993, detectives had failed to turn up any evidence that would lead to her killer. They also had been unable to find any evidence to lead them to whoever had killed Shauna just a few months before. But 1 month after Audrey's murder, another young woman would be found dead. In August 1993, 21-year-old Valencia Jumper was living in Charlotte and was a senior at Johnson C. Smith University, where she was majoring in political science. She also worked part-time at a Food Lion grocery store and a local department store. Valencia was originally from Columbia, South Carolina, where she was born and raised. After she graduated from high school at Columbia High School, she moved to Charlotte for school and moved into an apartment that she originally shared with a roommate before they moved out. Valencia's family and friends said that she was happy in Charlotte and looking forward to graduating. On August 9th, 1993, Valencia spoke to a friend of hers on the phone named Zachary, and they made plans to meet up that night. In the early morning hours of April 10th, Zachary went over to Valencia's apartment, but when he arrived, he could see smoke coming out of the window where she lived. Zachary went to the door of the apartment, and he said it was unlocked, and so he tried to go inside, but the smoke was too thick, and so he ran to a neighbor and asked them to call 911. When firefighters arrived and put out the blaze, they found Valencia's body in the bedroom. The initial investigation determined that the fire had originated from the stove and was likely caused by a pot being left on. When an autopsy was performed, the body was badly burned, but the ME determined that Valencia had died from thermal burns. When her family learned of her tragic death, they thought it was uncharacteristic of her to leave the stove on and fall asleep. She was usually careful about that kind of thing, but with the ME's ruling, they had no choice but to believe that this was a tragic accident. It would take 7 months before the truth would come out about what really happened to Valencia that night. But a month later, in September 1993, 20-year-old Michelle Stinson would become the fifth victim in this series of murders. At the time, Michelle was living in an apartment in Charlotte with her two children and was attending Central Piedmont College, where she was studying graphic design. Michelle was doing her best to maintain things while raising her boys and balancing school, but she was doing well in school and managed to maintain A's and B's in most of her classes. But on September 15th, 1993, a friend of Michelle's named James decided to stop by and visit her at the Grier Apartments where she lived with her children. When he arrived at the apartment, he knocked on the door, but no one answered. However, he could hear the children inside knocking on the window, and they were telling him that Mommy was asleep on the kitchen floor. James said that he thought that the children were just playing, but when he knocked again, Michelle did not come to the door. Figuring she was just taking a nap, James said he turned to leave, but as he did, Michelle's oldest son opened the door and grabbed him. James picked the boy up and went into the apartment, and there, lying on the kitchen floor in a puddle of blood, was Michelle Stinson. James picked up the phone to call 911, but he noticed that the cord had been cut, and so he took the children to a neighbor's where they called 911 and waited for the police. Once police arrived, they found a gruesome scene. Michelle had a towel wrapped around her neck, and she had been stabbed. But again, there were no signs of forced entry at this apartment. There had now been three victims that year that had been found strangled to death inside their own apartments with no forced entry. Two victims worked at Taco Bell, and all three victims, at some point, had been students at Central Piedmont College. This murder, however, did differ from the other two because Michelle had been stabbed. Now, despite the fact that there seemed to be a pattern emerging with young Black women being brutally murdered, police were still not seeing it. As news of these murders began to spread throughout the community, people were afraid. Someone was out there murdering young women and no one had been caught. And more importantly, it felt like no one was really doing anything to find the killer. Sadly, there were more victims to come. In February 1994, Vanessa Mack would be the first victim of that year. After Michelle Stinson's murder in the fall of 1993, there were no more murders or disappearances that year. Charlotte police, however, were feeling the heat as the community was asking more and more questions. But before they could answer any of them, Vanessa Mack would join the list of victims. In February 1994, Vanessa Mack was 25 years old and living in Charlotte with her two young daughters. At the time, she was working at Carolina Medical Center. According to reports, friends of Vanessa said that she had a rough childhood, but she was doing her best to be a good mom to her two children. On February 20th, 1994, the grandmother of her oldest daughter, Barbara, came over to Vanessa's apartment because she was supposed to pick up the children as she did every Sunday so that Vanessa could go to work. Barbara arrived at the apartment at around 6 a.m. and went to the back door and noticed that it was open. Barbara went inside and she called out to Vanessa but didn't get a response. Vanessa's four-month-old daughter was lying on the couch alone, which Barbara knew was strange. And so she went back to where Vanessa's bedroom was. And when she opened the door, she could see Vanessa's feet hanging over the bed. She was dead. Barbara took the children out of the apartment and went to a neighbor's to call 911. When detectives arrived, they found Vanessa with a towel around her neck, just like Michelle Stinson. There was blood coming from her nose and the back of her head. Her purse had also been emptied out, and the contents were scattered on the bed. And like the three other strangulation murder victims found in Charlotte over that past year, there were no signs of forced entry at the apartment. An autopsy later determined that Vanessa had died from ligature strangulation. One woman missing, four had been strangled in their own homes with no sign of forced entry, and one dies in a mysterious fire. Six women were all gone, and no one was being held accountable. But Vanessa's murder was not going to be the last. As the murders piled up in the community, they were becoming more and more angry with police about how these cases were being handled. Sylvia, Shauna's mother, was very vocal about her frustrations. Black people in Charlotte began to feel like no one cared about these women because they were Black. They believed that if these murders had been taking place in a different area, police would be handling things a whole lot differently. But after the murder of Vanessa Mack, the city would reach a boiling point when four more women were strangled to death. In March 1994, four women would be murdered, three in the span of 3 days. And these murders would turn the story in a whole new direction and lead detectives right to the path of America's first known Black serial killer. Join us next week as I bring you part two of this episode and the details about how police were finally able to narrow in on their suspect.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, TikTok, and Threads.
mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.